We are KOWS Occidental, 92.5 FM, streaming on the web at kowsfm.com.
Yeah, this is Bernie Steffen, and I'm here with my show called Ecologic. This is our eighth episode, so I'm starting to feel a little more comfortable in this chair. Today, our topic is nurturing free thinking, mostly in children, but also in adults. Let me just say that we tend to want to have independent thinkers, but we seem to be raising kids inside of a system designed for compliance, consumption, and constant input. We want to fill those brains. Well, I'm really pleased to have a guest here today who will help me, and neither one of us are experts in the field, but we have a concern about how it's been done and how we can do it better, that nurturing the free thinking. So I'm going to introduce my very special guest, and his name is Jean-Philippe Defoe. And JP, as he's also known, he's a creative. He's a professional photographer, and he's been in many newspapers, including the New York Times. And he's a mentor to youth, and that's where he's gotten a lot of insight. And you may also know that he's the Cal's host of The Kitchen Sink. And welcome, JP.
Merci. Thank you.
Yeah, you have a French name, but you have a bit of a British accent.
Well, you know, that's what happens when you're educated in London, but born from French parents.
So, okay.
You know, French school. French friends, or international friends, really. Most of my childhood was in London in a French system.
Well, I think you're very fortunate to have be multicultural, if you will. And I know you have a little girl. Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit about what language you speak at home.
Well, Huxley is now six, and the first language she learned was French, because my wife is also French. She grew up in New York, but with a French mother, and spent a lot of time in France over the summers as a kid. And so we decided that it was very important for Huxley to be a Francophile just like us. So the first language at home is French. And subsequently, we're really enjoying, you know, watching her be fully French.
Well, that's great. I was raised with German being my first language. And I learned my English, of course, when we moved to Canada at age four. Mm. But I necessarily didn't appreciate it as a child, but as an adult, I appreciate that I learned a second language. Mm-hmm. And a little bit of that second culture, because I think the more cultures we're exposed to, the better we can cope with the culture we're stuck with.
For sure. Yeah, yeah. I agree with that.
Yeah. So tell me a little bit about where you have worked with young people, both coaching them and mentoring them. And tell me about that experience and what it shows you, kind of a need that is here in our society.
Well, it all happened really by accident. I was at my photo studio in London, and a friend of mine who was a teacher at a Montessori school asked me to do a photographic workshop for 9-year-olds. And from that, a friend of mine, who at the time was a child psychiatrist, got wind of that, and he came to have a look whilst I was doing this workshop for a few weeks. And he brought me into an addiction clinic in London, and they then asked me, could I do a photo workshop for the kids that were in trouble that they had at the clinic? And I wasn't sure that a photographic workshop was what every kid wanted to do. And they said, you figure it out. And they gave me free rein. And the next thing I knew is that I was, you know, working with teenagers from the age of 12 through mid-20s who had anything from, you know, drug abuse, alcohol, sex abuse, shopping, money, gambling, all the kind of crap that we get up to in our teens, but was going out of control. And that I was the one adult that these kids met at the time who wasn't a parent, who wasn't a teacher, who wasn't a therapist or a psychiatrist or psychologist or a social worker or a cop even, right? I was that guy who would meet them and see them where they are and allow them to do the project that everyone else had said no to.
Can I translate that into they could trust you?
It takes time to build the trust. But yes, yeah. In principle, I was a guy who'd show up and who the sessions are designed to build trust with a teenager. And that then once they feel the trust in you, then they share what it is that they really want to do. And you embark on a creative endeavor with them and you support them.
And it's probably true for most that they had been betrayed by people they trusted in their lives. I'm guessing. I'm very generalizing here, but with a lot of youth at risk with drug abuse and other ways to escape, they're escaping something.
Correct. Yes.
and that is often about someone they trusted betraying them.
Yes. I mean, I think the home, you know, a lot of homes in all classes are broken. You know, people come from all sorts of different backgrounds, and the broken home is a common factor. The single parent home is a common factor in a lot of those things. An estranged father, an estranged mother, you know, all sorts of things have contributed to people's difficulty in growing up. And society is tough enough as it is. And if you are in a loving relationship with your parents and they're both there, but it gets more and more difficult, you know, when one of them's missing or absent frequently, or one parent has also addiction issues or, you know, all sorts of dysfunctional behaviors. And so how do you having an adult show up for them that's not there just once a week is going to be a solid presence. That was really, to me, like, how different might my life have been at 16 if I had had that?
So you identified with them. And how did you gain their trust in a general way?
By not knowing. And by that, I mean that the therapists that would recommend, or psychiatrists that would say, oh, yeah, next week, can you see this kid on a Tuesday or whatever? They would email you the file. And I'd say, I am not going to read the file. I need to know their name and how old they are. And that's all I care about. And then I'll show up. And I made that a point so that the kids would know that I hadn't read anything about them. Or if the parents would often call me and say, can I give you a bit of an outline? I'd say, you can, but I'd rather you didn't, so that I show up completely new and fresh and let them share with me what I need to know. And then later, perhaps, I can have a discussion with a therapist or a parent. But the priority was to meet these kids as if we had just met as randomly on the street as possible, and to build an honest trust that's not manufactured.
Can you talk a little bit about one or so of these kids in terms of obviously not identifying who they are, but tell us the story that they came with and how you were able to help them in a way?
Yeah, I mean, there's many stories, and a lot of them are very touching. There was a girl who weighed 38 kilos at the age of 15. That's below 78 pounds or something. So she was not doing well at all. She was majorly anorexic. And over time, we figured out that the priority was to get her weight up. So she had to follow all the clinical therapies that she was doing. And I could see that she sort of had an interest in food, but not the food that she was being prescribed. And I said, tell me more about that. And she said, well, you know, I'd love to know how to cook, but no one will let me. They want me to eat first.
Ah.
So I pushed for her to do a cookery course, and everyone said no. And then the mother called me up and said, I'd actually quite like to try that. You had a good idea. So we signed her up for a cordon bleu cookery course for 3 months. And the next thing is she's cooking dinner parties every weekend for her parents' guests. And then I got invited to one, which was incredible. And then she failed her exams at school, but she ended up getting a job in a hotel outside of London. And then she was hired by another restaurant in Scotland. And, you know, we sort of keep in touch randomly, but she's a sous chef now in a Michelin star restaurant. And so what a career that she might have not had.
Well, I love that story, and what the generality that I relate to with that is that when we want children to get educated or get well or get healthier and more social or whatever, we need to trust their curiosity, their interests, and support that. Mm. And I've shorthanded that always as focus on the learning, not on the teaching. They were all trying to teach her in a way that they, as adults, think about food or think about, isn't it nice that your mom's cooking for you and all you have to do is eat? But it sounds like they didn't uncover what that child needed. And it wasn't a therapist who uncovered it. It was JP.
It was a random guy with a camera and an idea. You're exactly right when you say fostering
learning.
How did you put it? Learning as opposed to teaching. One of the problems that she had was her father had moved around a lot in his career, and every time they set up home in a new town or country, that would last 2 years, and then he'd get moved to another job, and all the friends that she'd made would get severed. Friendships would end, and then she'd move on and start again. And for her, that was a huge problem. And his MO was that she had to do her exams to get into med school or law school. And I said to him in one meeting, she's got no interest in any of that stuff. And he looked at me and he said, that's not why I pay you. I pay you to make sure that she gets her exams and all this is nice, but I'm not interested. And you know, he was trying to shoehorn her into a life that she had no interest in living.
Well, isn't that so common that parenting is hard? And as parents, we feel a lot of responsibility that our kids turn out well. And then we listen to what society tells us is kids turning out well is getting a job, especially if you go to a university, which you need to really make the money to be successful. And there's sort of a plan for a child that comes from the parents. And it may not be that big, but it's not uncommon, I don't think. And again, I'm not the psychologist. My daughter is. She's a therapist, but
right.
I only pretend to be. So I think about how parents mean well, but too often they are imposing what they view as is best for this child and not trusting that the child can figure out what's best for themselves, and then they can encourage them along the way of where their curiosity is taking them. Because it's so amazing how you can learn and change if you're allowed to follow your curiosity.
Mm. What? I mean, exactly. One of the biggest loves in my life is I started skateboarding at the age of 5, and I still skateboard today, or discovered motorcycles in my teens, and that's a big part of my world. And a lot of my friends said to me when Huxley was born, oh, you know, you'll be putting on a skateboard then. And I said, yeah, when, you know, whenever the time comes, we'll have a go. And at the age of 2 or 3, she had a go, and she hasn't really bitten the, you know, the bug, as it were. And they're like, oh, yeah, I bet you're disappointed. And I'm like, no, I she tries things. And if that doesn't bite, let's see if there is something out there for her that would make her feel that her heart pumps a little bit faster when she does said activity, whether it's music, whether it's, you know, reading, whether it's a sport, I don't care.
Yeah.
As long as she finds joy and purpose and meaning in an activity,
yeah,
that's all I care about.
Well,
I can't prescribe it.
So with you. I mean, it doesn't start too young. I mean, it can start at a really fairly early age. Let's take a short break here, but I want to ask listeners, would you like to chime in on this conversation? We're talking about, you know, free thinking and nurturing that idea both in children and in adults. So if you got some ideas and just want to join the conversation, please call us here in the studio at 707-755-9250. When I started doing this show, I was excited about having guests, but I'm even more excited about getting callers. And so far in the 7 episodes before here, I think I've had one caller, and he's called 3 times on different shows. So I've called him my designated caller, and that's been great. But I'd like to know there's more than one or two people listening out there. And one way to show us that you're listening is to call in. So with that, let's hear from our underwriters.
Kaz thanks Occidental dentist Dr. Andrei Shevchuk. Dr. Shevchuk offers a full range of dental care, and his offices are located in Occidental at 4066 Bohemian Highway. You can reach his office by calling 707-874-2447.
Kaz thanks Stockholm Construction, a union company with decades of experience in completing construction projects throughout Sonoma County. You can find out more by visiting StockholmConstruction.com. Stockholm Construction proudly tunes into the Roots of Rock every Sunday morning at 7 Pacific on Kaz.
So this is Bernie Steffen. I'm back with Ecologic, and my guest here is Jean-Philippe Defoe. And we're talking about sort of learning, nurturing that free thinking, hopefully in children, but I also believe us adults could learn to be more free thinking outside of the box of what our culture, what our civilization is teaching us, because the world is getting ever more complex. And I may not have mentioned the phone number before, but it's 707-755-9250. So please give us a call. I mean, everybody has an opinion about children and education and learning. So, JP, let's talk a little bit about your creative side. You're a photography expert, and it's mostly of people?
Yes, portraiture.
So in portraiture, you are also looking at the emotions and the personality, and you're trying to capture all that in people. Does that help you gain insight when you're like talking with the at-risk youth or even with your own children?
So one of the things that came up with portraiture was always the contact and the connection to another human and how to best portray them, if you like, in the right context. And so often if you photograph somebody, it's not just about a beautiful portrait. It's about either the moment, but also the context of why we're photographing them. If it's for a New York Times article, there's often an angle. If it's a musician or a politician or a chef, there's always something out there that they are promoting. But in context of bringing that back to coaching, what I found was that I trained as an integral coach recently, and I was reminded of the fact that when you show up to a client in coaching, you have to leave all of your baggage at the door, and you have to show up a bit like unexposed film. And then as you experience your client and what they'd like to work on, they are impressing on you who they are. And in coaching, they use the analogy of you being a ball of clay that's been unsculpted. And I translated that into a sheet of unexposed film, which does the same thing. And then the session becomes the camera, and you absorb all the light from this client. And then you've allowed them to expose themselves to you. And then you can coach them and guide them through the process, as opposed to me trying to fix them or trying to tell them what to do. That's not the name of the game here.
If you're a listener right now and you have a child in a teen or older with some difficulty, and you think someone like Jean-Philippe might be helpful, there is a place you can check out his website. Could you tell our audience what that is?
Yeah, the website is called projectb612.com.
Give me a break. B612, what the hell's that?
So one of the things that I've always been prone to was curiosity and the ability to discover new things, like you said, learning as opposed to teaching. And when I was 5 or 4, perhaps, one of the first books that my mother introduced to me was The Little Prince by Antoine de Saint-Exupéry, of this kid that comes from outer space that lands on Earth and meets a guy who's struggling in the middle of the desert. It's a very well-known book. It was published in the mid-40s, and I've come back to that book all the time. I reread it regularly, and I've handed it out to all the kids that I've worked with. So I've probably bought, over the years, 400 or 500 copies.
And the name of that book
so
is?
So it's called The Little Prince.
The Little Prince.
The Little Prince.
So what does it have to do with B61?
And so he comes from outer space, but actually his home is an asteroid, and he comes from an asteroid that is called B612.
Oh.
So I've called this project, Project B612, because it's an exploration in curiosity. And all he does is show up on Earth and asks questions about everything. So it's a kind of like he might be an alien, but he's just a human from another planet and goes, what's going on here? And they, back in the 40s, the writer describes all the things that were abnormal about the world and that required us to pay attention and to imagine and to be curious about. And nothing's changed. You know, 70, 80 years later, that book is still more relevant now than ever.
So I'm sorry for being illiterate, because I don't read books and I didn't know that book. But now the B612 will stick with me. What came before that in the URL?
Oh, sorry. It's www.
We don't do that anymore.
ProjectB612.com.
ProjectB612.com. Calm. Perfect.
Yeah.
So I would recommend you give a look. Mm. And then if you want to take it further, you know how to reach JP. Yeah,
there's a page to connect, and just drop me a line. And, you know, so we do an intro call in the beginning to just get a sense of what people want to, what kind of work they want to do, if it's for a child, if it's for an adult. I coach adults as well. And then see, you know, what it is that people want to work on and try and figure out how to guide them and how to support them.
Fantastic. I want to take a little bit of a turn now at a younger age. Mm-hmm. And your youngest child is how old?
Oh, my only youngest child is 6.
Okay. Yeah. So your daughter, mm-hmm, at 6 is going to a Montessori school.
Correct.
How did you come to choose the Montessori method for her in the preschool that she's at?
Well, there were two things. My wife was educated in Montessori.
Okay.
So she already had it that was a good option. I've only known good things about Montessori through friends and through a friend of mine who's also a Montessori teacher. So I've always seen that as that would have been great had I gone through that. We looked at the Waldorf Steiner model also as a possibility. And in the end, you know, you have to pay attention to your child. And we went looking at schools. And when we found the Montessori school that she started in, that was a great place to start for her when she was 18 months. And then after that, we moved her to another one. And then that one she outgrew, because it was for only small children. And now she's at a place in Petaluma, which is she's finishing the first 3-year course effectively. And as of next year, she will be in another Montessori school.
And you're quite satisfied with how she's working within that system?
I am enjoying watching her grow.
Fantastic.
And so it's what you would call child-led learning.
As, yeah.
And so there's a bunch of work that they have to get through, but at the same time, they get to choose, but they can't also ignore the other stuff. So they get guided, as opposed to sat in a room where, you know, you will obey. You will do what I tell you. That's none of that. It's
have you already taken out an application for Harvard for her? Or you're not that kind of parent?
No. I mean, everyone said to me, you know, from the moment she's born, you need to put aside college money. And there is that. We're having that discussion and figuring out how that works. But no, we're not interested. You know, I don't know where she's going to end up. She could end up being a chef. She could end up going.
So standardized curriculum is not what you are going for, or high SAT scores, that's not your goal for her.
If it's what she decides, then yes, I'll have to pay attention to that.
Okay.
My wife is far more academically minded than I am. Her path was much more academic. Mine was much more creative path. But we both agreed that, you know, she's a human and they are their own entity from birth. So you have to pay attention.
And my path to Montessori, I'm going to share a little bit of my experience with it, was with our two kids, a daughter and a son, 2 years apart. And they were going to Montessori preschool. And I had some misconceptions about what Montessori was. I said, okay, it's Italian, it's probably Catholic, it's probably disciplinary. So I was way wrong, but I went to the parent nights and I listened to the director. They don't call them teachers, which is a good thing. The director kind of informed us how it is ultimately about following the child, and I started getting more learning about what Maria Montessori first found when she was exposed to teaching that was mostly dominated in her time in Italy by men that were coming at it from a more top-down, authoritative way. This is what you need to know. Mm. Well, when the male teacher would leave the room, she would observe what were the children doing. The mood changed completely, and she saw what they were interested in, what they were drawn to. And then she studied that more and more and came to the conclusion that at different age groups, you need different things. You know, so the preschool versus the elementary school versus the high school, by the time you're in high school, she said, they don't need any more facts in their head. Mm. You know, they do that really well at middle school. Yeah. I mean, she didn't use those age markers, but we can take from that, you know, she really nailed it in terms of they can learn so much more at that early age, which we call preschool, mm-hmm. by manipulating things, by touching and feeling and being with things that help you learn.
Mm-hmm. One of her quotes is that she said, the greatest thing we can give our children are the roots of responsibility and the wings of independence. And I think that really sums up what Montessori is about. And in the conventional system, in the matrix, that's a problem because you're nurturing free thinking. You're yeah. getting them to think for themselves, to be critical about the world, to be questioning the world. And you don't live in a society where that's acceptable, because the moment someone shows up with a bunch of questions, they're a pain in the backside.
We put so much emphasis on standardized curriculum, generally, nationally, globally, in Texas, in California, and we have small districts that try to become bigger districts so that there's more of a standard for everyone. Mm. We're going in the wrong direction. There once was a time where you considered a person intelligent if they had studied the Greek philosophers or the early scientists like Archimedes and then the Romans and cultures. And you could then go into British and Shakespeare and Dickens and all sorts of things and be considered well-educated. Mm. But what humanity is learning every year in terms of research and knowledge is exponential. Mm. And it's grown to a point where anyone claiming to have the wisdom to be able to comprehend all that, which is what we try to get AI to do, we get to try to get it down so that it can feed us wisdom. Well, it can summarize what the most popular opinion is, but it can't give us wisdom. And the wisdom really comes down to a more granular level. And I wanted to do a little bit more about the groupings that Maria Montessori taught about. One of them is high school, because I for a while saw that from my granddaughter, who had talked about her experience in her high school situation around, or it was even junior high, I'm sorry, around math teachers. I went to talk to the principal about this isn't working. They don't really understand math. They're not really teaching it. They're trying to keep up with what the curriculum is. She said, well, yeah, we live here in the Bay Area, and anyone who's good at math is being paid three times as much as we can pay in Silicon Valley. Mm. They're a commodity, but no longer for schools. Yeah. So I decided I might want to become a teacher. But after sitting one day within the classroom, I knew exactly what Maria Montessori was talking about. Mm. The teacher was trying to teach a lesson about something. And he'd be lucky if three people in the classroom of 30 were actually following him. The rest were passing notes or falling asleep or whatever. And the minute the bell rang, boy, their energy exploded. They went out in the halls and they're talking about what happened yesterday and guess who's dating who. And, you know, and she talked about at that high school age, it's about socialization. It's about teamwork. The best kind of an education you can give that kind of a person is get them working on a farm for themselves, or being as a group responsible for a portion of the farm, or running a business, you know, being in an effort that has a focus and then learns on how to cooperate in teamwork to get things accomplished. Mm. And we don't have that in our high school ages. We used to have shop that would, it taught me a little bit of metalworking, a little bit of woodworking, had me have some appreciation for that. And of course the girls were given about home economics and food preparation. And I can see where that was sexist, but that was no reason to abandon the idea that those are still skills that if someone is pursuing, like the example you talked about, might have been exposed to a culinary career by starting and learning some basics about food preparation in school. Why don't we value that? And why do we only value that academic experience? And then we stop listening to people who only have gotten that kind of an education, but we're listening to PhDs who are on the edges of research and have just discovered something, and they're winning a Nobel Peace Prize, and they're in 1,000 different fields expanding human knowledge. And with our computers, that knowledge is being shared ubiquitously. You'd think we'd have enough knowledge, and somehow we're stupid as hell.
Well, there's a lot in there, but mostly I agree with a lot of that. To come back to a point that you made earlier about being kids being in the class and being distracted or daydreaming, boredom is an essential component of being a kid, even an adult. Every now and again, you are distracted, daydreaming, bored, someone's talking and you're not interested, you disconnect. That's totally normal, but society frowns upon that. So we want our children to be successful. Who says? We just want our children to find joy. This whole game of the pursuit of happiness, you know, what the capitalist system is: bigger, better, faster, more. It's never enough. You're always in this matrix of wanting to perform or to outperform others, to outplay, to outwit, and to score higher. So we're into the scoring game, whether you it's a basketball game or whether it's a
money is the main thing we measure things by.
But one of the things I wanted to come back to is you talked about wisdom, and yes, we achieve wisdom with time and experience, and we fail and we learn and we fail and we learn, and you can dust yourself down and start again tomorrow. But something that's not really celebrated is we look at the system rates kids for their IQ. It doesn't look at their EQ, their emotional qualities. That's the bit that I think is often lacking. And so that's why then, well, if your IQ is not at a certain level, then, you know, you don't make the grade, you don't get into said school, you don't live in the right neighborhood, you don't drive the right car, you don't have the right job, you can't go to the right restaurant, blah, blah, blah. And that's really one of the systems that these kids are being funneled into. We all were. Yeah. And at some point, the question is, maybe I don't want to do that. You know, maybe I want to, someone's going to say no. And so Maria Montessori was all for the independent thinking from a very early age.
When we were raising our kids at that age and experiencing Montessori, we're in West Marin, and there was a large proportion of the population that was doing homeschooling. And my daughter would date a boy who was homeschooled, and I met various ones through our kids' associations. And I was always impressed with how they carried themselves, how mature they were, mm-hmm. and how they were well-informed. And I know that when parents hear the idea of homeschooling, they think, oh, I got to be the teacher. I got to have the knowledge. I got to feed that all into my child. No, you don't. You don't. That would be a huge mistake to come at it from the teaching angle. Mm-hmm. The support is what's needed for homeschooling. The idea that when your child says, hey, Mom, I'm really wondering how this works, help guiding them to resources that they can use to discover what that is or where they can learn. It may be finding the right YouTube channel for them. So I'm not opposed to them using the internet, but I'm for the idea of supporting the curiosity so that they will that will take the kids that were in the classroom that I was observing. There, a lot of teaching was going on, but the percentage of learning was maybe 5% of that. Whereas when a kid is curious, it's 100% learning.
But you see, all kids are curious. It's just that when they get into the school system, they get funneled into ways of being curious that might not be the way they are. And so one of the things about homeschooling, which shifted during the pandemic and post, is that homeschooling became a much more normal, acceptable thing. But kids still need community, right? Libraries have become more and more relevant again, whereas for a while they disappeared because you could get a book on the internet, you could get a book on a screen, on a Kindle, on a phone, whatever. And we've now understood and accepted that the screen is a big problem for kids and they shouldn't be on one for as long as possible. And that's another problem and then a whole other show, if you like. But the reality of the community that's lacking is that, well, if they're being homeschooled, often they still connect with sport, with play, which is one of the major components of being a child and a growing adolescent, and then community in a library format or different types of learning environments that are not structured like a school.
Yeah, you're so right. And I saw where actually to be qualified to be have your child as a homeschooler, you have to actually register with the school district. And that is to help the parent get the child close to other children to be involved in activities that may be sports, may be music, may be something else. So that need is just as great.
Yeah.
So it isn't about, you know, inside the house, but I also want to expand the notion that we as parents shouldn't think of, well, you know, I outsource my dental work to my dentist and I outsource my kids' education to the teaching institution. No, as a parent, one of your main responsibilities is to help your kids learn. And you can do that regardless of what education you've had, because the love that comes with caring about your child's well-being is enough. And that carries a long way. And so getting the support of institutions, even like the school district, but not making the kid sit in that school district at a desk and the bell rings and now you're sitting at a different desk with a different teacher in front. There are ways that schools are run, like Montessori. Waldorf is more like that. There are ways that it can be done so that the child is making choices and is active in that environment and is interacting with other children, as opposed to having to be someone who can recount what the teacher has told you and can pass the test, get an A, and come home with a report card and get an attaboy for getting an A. That's the part I don't like. It's all about these artificial rewards for a system that is all about teaching. And when you hear about politicians talk about what we need to do about education, they're totally focused on what we need to teach, when we need to teach it, what the standardized curriculum must contain. And now we must acknowledge pronouns that people want. That's right wing, so we can't do that. So it's like it gets really crazy trying to standardize teaching. De-standardize it, decouple it from standard institutions, make the home the center of the... For example, if you're gardening and you're growing vegetables, get your child involved in that. When you're working around the home, get your child involved in the cleaning. Get them in, or the decorating, or the what have you. I'm saying, I think if we see ourselves as parents as being sort of the love shield we put around our child, then teaching through other people who have been trained and are academically, informationally rich, and can help your child pursue that line, that's great, but it doesn't mean you've totally outsourced. And if your child doesn't do it well in that school, some parents are the ones that go down to the principal's office and say, how come my kid is not doing better?
Well, I've had plenty of those conversations with, you know, principals of schools and psychiatrists and, you know, social workers over the years to go, you know, how can we fix them? And the question is, I'm often the one that's the black sheep of the flock in terms of the adults that are helping these kids, because I don't play by their rules. I'm not bound by any.
Yeah.
My mission is to let that child be seen. And how can I help them then turn up the loudspeaker of what they're seeing back? And, you know, we all went to school systems, you know, back when we were kids that were, you know, we could see. I can remember things that happened that I knew weren't right, you know, at school as a kid. And I still remember what those things are. And in many cases, none of those things have changed. And part of me is thinking, wow. The biggest fear we have as adults in this world is the change. So when you talk about a school education system, pretty much global, that it's more than bust, it's kind of like busting at the seams, and it needs to be re-examined. And we've moved on how we live our lives so much, but that machine is still stuck.
Yeah,
it's like an engine about to seize. You know, there's no money going in it, and there's just no oil, and it's just going to bust. And change is one of the things that we fear the most.
I remember when I was doing the talk show with Bing Gong at KWMR and Point Reyes Station, I was getting more radical all the time, and we had interesting guests on. And we had this Russian fellow, Dmitry Orlov, I think, who came on, and he proposed something that shocked me, but now I get. I said, what's the first thing we need to do to sort of gear up for what's coming? He said, close all the universities. To a lot of people, that sounds totally insane. At the time, I questioned it too. It's like, well, how would we learn and stuff? Well, the truth is, the universities are part of the civilization that is the problem. And they can't examine the industrial world global civilization critically enough to suggest abandoning it and going back to an earlier form of living, of low energy, of living without airplanes, without cars, without internet, see, that's where I believe we're headed. And that the preparation for that starts with our thinking. And, you know, I'm not really wanting to debate that too much, but I want to suggest that people have recommended getting away from our entire structure, including the universities.
I think one of the things with that, in principle, that's a nice idea, and I agree with that to a certain degree. But, you know, I know plenty of people who have been to, you know, Ivy League, Oxford, Cambridge in England, La Sorbonne in France, and, you know, Harvard and Stanford and all the big name schools all over the world, who, you know, come out of there and, you know, they read English for 4 years and they come out and they get a job in finance. And you're going, just because you have a first at Oxford gets you the open door in so many places because you have, you know, a degree. And yet they end up pursuing a career for 20 years that they actually did not train for and that they have no interest in. But because the rewards are so huge, oh, I'll put up with that. I'll stay here because it'll, you know, one day it'll buy me that freedom. And you're like, well, you know, you could choose the freedom now. And, you know, what do you really need? And because we're sold this thing about, you know, buy the new car every year, live in the right neighborhood, go to the right schools, you know, eat at the right restaurants, wear the right clothes, etc., then everyone can be seduced by the desire of being part of a financial ecosystem that will deliver those things. But I think that fundamentally, people know that if they go to study something at a university that they really want to study, then it's tougher to find a career in that when you leave, because the rewards are not as great.
Well, we are quite apart on how we see both the now and where we're headed. Mm. However, let me just push back a little bit on the idea that the people you're talking about who've gone to Oxford or Harvard are the elites of the elites, and they can do critical thinking already in most cases. They come with a high degree of education, and then they clearly are in a good position within a system that rewards that skill and that knowledge in that system.
But not necessarily in the right application. What I'm saying is that if you go and study literature for 4 years, what the hell are you doing getting a job in finance?
Well, see, I'm not going to go down that path with you. I think that's fine. I think actually changing careers is something I did, quite different. And it's helpful to actually have more than one. But I want to suggest that when there is a, for example, let's say we had a power outage for a month. Who's the best taught? Who has the best skills for survival in that in situation? I would suggest it's much more the low education people, if you will, that have learned to survive on the streets, that are able to hunt and gather foods and know what to glean and can be eaten and can survive as a animal in a world that is changing so rapidly that the people who are in their gated community or their big gated home, they can't get that gate open because the electricity is off and the gardener's not there to tell them how.
And there are a million restrictions legally about what they should or shouldn't be doing about that gate because, oh, you're not that person, so you can't touch it. I just want to come back to a point that you just made and the notion that Ivy League or, you know, preparing a college fund is the question that people give you when a child is born always. And, you know, there's a shift in thinking. It's always been around, but we also need people to do manual jobs. And you might need to go to a further education system to learn how to be a plumber, an electrician, a carpenter, a mechanic, an engineer, whatever, that doesn't require you to go and pursue these high-level academic accolades that then mean that you can't fix a gate when it breaks, because actually the person that is a manual worker, like you said, those are the people that keep all this stuff alive. The service industry,
right?
You know, I grew up with a father who was a chef who ran a restaurant, and I'll always remember we were at a dinner with some friends of his one weekend, and someone asked him, "Do you consider yourself to be working class?" And or upper class or middle class. And my father said, I'm working class. And his friend said, no, don't be so ridiculous. You're not working class. You own a restaurant and a wine company. You're not working class. And my father looked at him and said, when the waiter calls in sick one morning, who has to do the mise en place in the restaurant? Who has to do the clean the loos and make sure that his role is fulfilled? He goes, I suddenly go from being the patron of the restaurant, the owner, to now I'm cleaning the loo. And he goes, because it's my restaurant, and I need to make sure that that's done, and I need to know that I know how to do that. And he grew up in the 50s, you know, shoveling coal in ovens and kitchens, and then learning the ranks and rising up through the ranks of being a chef. And that's the thing that I think somewhere there's a loss of that, or when people do go down that route. I learned photography by starting being an assistant when I was 17, and I was pushing a broom and making tea all day. That was it. I wasn't touching cameras or film. I had to learn, and very quickly you transition.
Well, I totally understand that, agree with that. I mean, I'm not a big fan of the class system, and I don't take much from the Bible. But a term that sticks in my ear is the meek shall inherit the earth. For that prophecy to make sense to me, it means more that the lower class will have a better chance of surviving a civilizational, a global economic collapse than those of us like me who sit behind a computer and have very few skills in the garden, in the kitchen, in the anywhere, compared to someone raised on a farm or involved in a business, as you were talking about. So those hands-on jobs that are not depending on digital content or virtual entities, that's what really matters. And so I think we are going to go turning this power system upside down at some point.
I wonder if there's a link to what you're saying with, if I look back at the decades, you know, people talk about, post-war, particularly in Europe, but a bit in America, I've heard that you know, the 60s happened and there was an explosion of popular culture. And I think there was like a pressure valve being released because, you know, teenagers and young adults in the 60s had so much darkness of growing up post-war that suddenly, you know, free love, everything happened then. London was a swinging place. My father talks about the 60s and how, you know, he met my mum and it was just like rock and roll for a decade. The 70s arrived and people were then, you know, settling down and still pursuing that level of a lifestyle that was way above where they came from. And then the 80s was a sort of weird pursuit of luxury, you know, the big clothes, the big cars, the Dallas TV show of, you know, people living a lifestyle that everybody aspired to, the right things. And then suddenly in the 90s it became something else, and then now we're in the 2000s, and it was sort of the arrival of the internet, so to speak, and the explosion of technology. And if you don't have any or you don't know how to use it, you are a relic and you're outcast. And I wonder, somewhere in this, and you've been through those decades, if you've seen that evolution of the class system somewhere kind of kidding itself that, you know, and forgetting about the basics.
I feel like a very lucky person to have lived through amazing change. You know, my parents moved from Germany with their only child, me, to want a better life for me than they had. And that was a standard from that generation. So us baby boomers expected to ever grow more wealthy, more comfortable, more capable, more accomplished, more successful. And that exploded because we were a population bomb. I was lucky at age 16 in the 65 to have my parents move us to Southern California. Mm-hmm. Hey, we have a caller. I'm going to pause that question.
Do it.
And hi, you're on the air? Hi, can you hear me? Oh, I know what's wrong. Hang on. Fader, can I hear you now? Hi, caller, are you there? Oh, I'm pushing the wrong buttons. I'm so sorry. Caller, are you still there?
I'm still here.
Oh, Jeff, thank you so much. And thanks for bearing with my clumsiness here.
Well, I'm enjoying the show very much. But I did want to bring up a distinction between the term free thinker and critical thinker, which I think is very important because they certainly overlap, but they're distinct in what they entail. A free thinker, to me, is someone who does not rely simply upon authority to come up with their own ideas. But people throw around the idea, they think they're a free thinker. For instance, the people who say the earth is flat would probably put themselves in the category of rejecting authority, rejecting science, and they're free to think that the world is flat and so forth and so on. So just free thinking without critical thinking, without tools to examine the ideas and test them, and see what's true and what's not true. Free thinking can, you know, the term free thinking can be used to justify all sorts of nonsense.
Well,
what I'm really curious about is how can we, I grew up in a school system that encouraged critical thinking, thankfully, and my father was an engineer. He encouraged critical thinking until, of course, I started to question him. Then he wasn't too happy about it. But how can we encourage critical thinking in schools? Not just the idea that we don't have to believe something because all these dead generations believed it, but how do we examine ideas that we have now critically?
Well, I'm so glad you called in with that thought, and you're absolutely right. You said but I would say it's an and, because when I think about free thinking, it means thinking critically as well. That it's not about, Earth is flat. That to me is a non sequitur, but it is indeed being able to think outside of the box. And another way to think of that is critical thinking. So JP wants to add something here.
Yeah, I take your point very well. I like that distinction that you made between free thinking and critical thinking. And I do, yes, I subscribe to that totally, in the sense that there is a resistance to authority or to facts, perhaps, versus the tools.
Yes, going
to,
back to the Enlightenment.
Yes.
Age of Enlightenment, where they rejected traditional thinking, you know, from the church and so forth, and tried to chart their own path.
But to go back to your question about how can we encourage critical thinking, that's one of the things that I look at in teenagers who are struggling with that whole machine of you must think this way, the matrix, if you will. And it's just it's as simple as allowing the curiosity gene to grow in an individual, to just be naturally curious without expectation and without pursuing a particular outcome. It's just you don't know. And when you're 10, 8, 5, 12, 15, 16, whatever age you are in those formative years, it's difficult to remain naturally curious because you're always facing adulthood who has an authority on said subject. There's always someone that knows and that will box you back in to, no, it's not what you thought. This is the reality and this is how it is. And then kids have always been known to ask why. You know, why? And I'm experiencing that currently with a six-year-old, and I'm delighted that, you know, one of the things that it doesn't scare me, it fascinates me, that I have to think about, okay, why? Or how do I explain that in a way that remains open for her to dig even deeper? I don't just want to give her an answer and hope that she's satisfied with that and goes away. I want a kid to think about that and then to come back and say, oh, yesterday you said that. How about this? So that the dialogue remains open and that we're not being curious to just, you know, push the status quo. We're being curious to learn something and to understand how we can grow and allow difference. You know, that's really the fundamental crux of it, from my perspective anyway.
Mm-hmm. Well, certainly enjoy the show.
So. Well, before you go, Jeff, I mean, I believe that you're a critical thinker, clearly, because you still listen to this show. We're still friends, and we see some things differently, but I like that we're able to have dialogue around those differences. And I love that you do improv, and I'll just remind you, they don't use the word but. Okay, you opened my show here or calling in with a but. I don't think it was a but at all, but thank you if that motivated you.
Thanks a lot.
Okay. Thank you, and I hope you encourage other callers.
Point I think I'm trying to make, the central point, is that curiosity is good.
Mm. Yes.
It's absolutely fundamental for development, human development.
I agree with that.
My concern, especially with media these days that kids have access to, and adults as well, is that curiosity can lead people down a rabbit hole, and then all of a sudden they're caught in an echo chamber, and if they don't have the tools to use critical thinking to evaluate the ideas that are being presented to them, they can be caught in some very bad situations and end up believing things that do a disservice to them.
Well, that is very well put. I agree with that wholeheartedly. I think, unfortunately, a lot of people are trapped by being in a polarized political system where you're either this or you're that and can't get out of that trap.
Yes, that's why critical thinking is so important, so people can evaluate both sides of an argument and go deeper instead of just being caught on that one side.
Great, great. Well, that's a very important addition here to our show. And thank you for being my one caller. I'm hoping you'll inspire others, but I'm so grateful that you called and model a behavior that I'm trying to encourage.
Well, thanks, Bernie.
All righty, Jeff.
And thank you to your guest. Very interesting.
Thank you, Jeff. You should be on the show.
He is on the show. All righty, Jeff. See you later.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Well, that was nice having Jeff call in, and